You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Peter Kraut with me. Peter was with me briefly, very briefly, all too briefly, back on July 12th, and that's why we just didn't have time to even begin to scratch the surface of the things that Peter had to tell us. So I'm really happy that he could come back with us today. Primarily, we want to focus on some of the ideas in his book, The Great Silver Bull, which you can pick up at Amazon. I think if you're interested in investing and interested in silver and the precious metals, this is a must read. I did pass on in my introduction to today's show some glaring positive comments about the book from Ross Beatty, and there's other people as well that have read it. It is really a very extensive read about silver. So if you're really into silver, this is a must read. Peter, thanks so much for joining me again.
Well, thanks so much to you, Jay, and thanks for that that intro.
You know, you're obviously a silver bull. You wouldn't be writing a book like that, I suppose. Otherwise,
that's right.
But silver, like gold, has been a disappointment to a lot of us who are in the hard money sector with the precious metals. Why do you think silver hasn't done particularly well, even though we're seeing these high inflation rates?
Absolutely. So you're right. I mean, a lot of us, most of us, I think, probably that are that understand this sector, certainly have expected that gold and silver would have done better, and the associated mining stocks as well. And they have sold off. The metals have sold off. The mining stocks have sold off. And there are a few reasons for that. I think one of the best, or two of the biggest reasons, are that the Fed's been in a rate hiking cycle, so they've been raising rates and are expected to raise rates probably again tomorrow, significantly at least on an interim basis, that has scared, I think, people in general. You know, if you look at what stocks and bonds have done, that has hurt those sectors as well, because higher rates hurt nearly everything. What they don't hurt, though, is the dollar. So it attracts money to the U.S. dollar. It's also been bought up as a haven, a safe haven, and shorter-term bonds tend to pay more because rates are going up. So it's attracted money to the dollar. The dollar has gotten stronger, and a stronger dollar means it takes less dollars to buy precious metals. Mm-hmm. So when it takes less dollars to buy precious metals, their prices go down. And so that's what we've seen happen. And that's as much true, certainly, for gold as it is for silver. Gold, I should say, somewhat less, in fact, for gold than it is for silver, simply because gold, I think, is the first sort of go-to when it comes to a haven. So actually, gold has held up relatively well, and silver has gone down, certainly not as much as stocks and even bonds have, especially since the start of the year. But you know, I think investors need to be able to understand, look at the bigger picture, zoom out, step back, filter out some of the noise, and realize that the setup that we have right now could hardly be better. And I think that if you have a really good perspective, which is something that, as you mentioned, I mean, I really, really strive for that in the book. That's what I want people to be able to get from the book, is that you look back through history and you see what circumstances we're in now have often repeated, and how silver has performed in those kinds of environments. And as Ross Beatty says in the foreword for the book, we are in exactly the kind of environment when silver tends to perform very well. And so in the recent sort of near medium term, it has underperformed. But that actually helps to set up a tremendous forward outlook for both the metals and the associated stocks.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly you mentioned the conditions that we're in now, rising interest rates, and you mentioned in your note to me that the Fed is trapped. It really can't raise rates much further, even though inflation rates are very high, and it feels the need to raise rates. But if it does, the whole the dominoes will start tipping over, and so it can't really raise rates. You say maybe you want to just comment on why the Fed is trapped and why it's gotten itself into this position.
Absolutely, and I think that if there is a key that everyone really needs to understand, it's exactly that right now. I think that's sort of the single most important thing for people to understand and realize. It's not something complicated, but if they do realize it and understand it, then they'll understand the fallout from it. And so that's exactly it. I do say that the Fed is trapped in the sense that, if we look at recent inflation numbers, we're at 9.1% in the U.S., we're at 8.1% in Canada. These are 40-year highs in inflation. And the Fed really ought to, and knows it ought to, everyone knows, it's not a secret, that the Fed really ought to be raising rates. In fact, if it were to properly fight inflation, it should be at rates, at the very least, that are close to or above official inflation, which is at 9% mm-hmm. right now. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners think that the Fed is able to raise rates to 9%, but I think the odds of that are very, very close to zero.
Right.
I mean, it's quite clear that if you look at things like government, the size of government debt, the size of business debt, consumer debt, car loans, mortgages, student debt, it just, they're almost all at record highs, and this has grown to these levels and has been sustainable because of low rates. So mm-hmm. if you think for a moment that, I mean, some of the research tells us that if the Fed were to raise rates to just 3%, the U.S. national budget would see about 20% of it go to just paying the interest. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge right. chunk of the annual budget for the U.S. And again, so the Fed really, I mean, if it did raise rates enough, let's say it went to 6, 7, 8, 9%, that would clearly, crush the housing sector. It would devastate business. It would severely handicap government spending, because so much of it would go to interest payments. It would devastate student loans, car mm-hmm. loans. It just goes on and on and on. So, I mean, if you see all of this, you understand it. To me, what the conclusion I come to through all of that is that it knows it should raise rates. It should be raising rates. It's incapable of sufficiently raising rates, and therefore it will talk tough. That's really all it has, is the ability mm-hmm. to try and manage expectations. So it will absolutely talk tough, make it sound like it's going to keep fighting inflation, but in fact it will absolutely be unable to, and inflation will stay high and continue to stay high for an extended period. I think we're on to probably a decade's worth in total, at least, of high inflation. And that's the biggest threat to everyone's wealth. They really need to understand that and look at what the implications are in terms of how to deal with it. And silver is absolutely at least one part of the answer to how to deal with high and ongoing high inflation.
I have a sense that we won't be able to get anywhere nearly that level that you mentioned of interest rates to break to cure inflation. It's my sense that long before we get there, we'll have a devastating decline in the economic activity that will probably make demand so weak that interest rates will fall. And then we're going to have to see what I think will drive silver. And you're very bullish on silver. I'm looking at silver now. It's got to be, not too far off the bottom from the last 20, 22 years or so. Mm-hmm. It hit $46 in 2011, I think, is what I saw on the chart. It's, where is it now? Around 1870 or
exactly.
something like that.
Yeah.
So the table is set, you said. If they keep raising rates, and my sense is that they can't keep raising rates before they break something and the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. That's my thought. And so that probably long before we get to that 9% level that you're talking about, you know, demand will be so devastated that rates will fall. And then they're going to have to be, they're going to have probably start to reinflate again. Would that be the time, Peter, when you think we might see silver really starting to pick up gold and as well?
Yes, that's exactly right. That is the kind of narrative and scenario that I see playing out. It may even come as soon as they pause in rate hikes, because I think the market will realize that, I mean, it all depends, you know, on expectation management and presentation and so on. But there, I think odds are high that the market will realize that the Fed knows it's reached its limit at that point. And imagine if it barely makes it to, say, raising rates to 3% or so, or perhaps slightly above 3%, that it would need to potentially start cutting rates from that point, as you say, if, you know, they've helped to cause a recession. So imagine how few bullets they have to fight inflation, to fight a downturn if they've only been able to raise rates to somewhere around 3%. That really gives them very little room. And so they'll, you know, a lot of other measures would end up being coming into play, other tools, renewed quantitative easing, things like monetizing the debt. And we've talked about things like modern monetary theory, where the deficits, the annual deficits, are just regarded as something not to be worried about anymore. And it's funny because modern monetary theory was all presented on the idea that we didn't have to worry about inflation. Well, a lot of these modern monetary theorists are sticking their heads in the sand and backing off right now, because the inflation has come roaring. And it's clear to I think the rest of us, at least, that modern monetary theory simply doesn't work, and it's something out in la la land, and it's just a bit of a pipe dream. You know, the Fed allowing, or I'm going to put in quotes, allowing inflation to run high, really in a sense suits it and suits the government, because. Mm-hmm. High inflation means a devaluing currency, and a devaluing currency means making paying back huge debt easier over time. And so I actually believe that's actually part of the plan, is to have inflation high and run high, and a Fed that feels like it really can't do much about it, and actually not do really much about it, and allow that to go on for an extended period in order to try and, to some extent at least, manage repaying the debt.
Right. I suspect that you're right about that, but they just want to make sure it doesn't happen too rapidly. Hyperinflation would you know, cause them to lose their currency, perhaps, and then the whole, you know, the whole empire comes tumbling down, and that's certainly not something the Federal Reserve wants. There are some people that have had on this show that believe that as long as Jerome Powell is there, there won't be any monetary theory. And he seems, in fact, David Stockman, who was on this show recently, suggested that he doesn't think we're going to see any Powell pivot anytime soon. Because of the anger that's out there with regard to inflation, especially among, you know, the middle class, lower middle class people that are really having a tough time of it. So that's an interesting, you know, he points out that this time is so much different, because before, when Powell pivoted, we had a 2%, under 2% inflation rate, and there was no harm. But this time, the political pressure is on Powell to fix this inflation rate, inflation problem. On the other hand, if it gets too tight, you know, you've got the ultra liberals over there that are screaming and hollering that it's all his fault. Those are the ones that want to put MMT in place, I guess. Well, Peter, let me ask you this: you're talking about, talk a little bit about the fundamentals. We're really touching on the monetary aspects of silver so far. There are industrial aspects that are coming into play like never before, and you're talking about the potential for a $300 per ounce silver price, which I think is, you know, who knows what the dollar, to me, it depends on where the dollar goes to a great extent. So any number is possible, in my view, depending on the dollar and a lot of other factors. But maybe just talk a little bit about the fundamentals for silver and why, you know, those higher numbers are certainly reasonable and not crazy stuff.
Right. So a little more than half, 54% in fact, of silver is used for industrial applications. And again, just sort of an interesting point to note is that the all-in cost to produce an ounce of silver is right around $18. And we're just slightly above that right now, just $18.50 or so. And so, in my view at least, it's always possible, and it does happen for some commodities for usually short periods of time, that if you get enough external pressure that and sentiment, in fact, as well, that you can get the commodity trading below its cost of production, but it usually doesn't last long because the producers will try to adjust and scale back and so on. So I believe the approximately $18 range helps to provide a floor. And because industrial uses are so important and so consistent and so supported as well, even by government, because silver has truly become a green metal. Mm-hmm. The single biggest use of any kind for silver is for solar panels. So 11% of all of the silver consumed every year goes just to solar panels. And the coming technologies, the next generation technologies in solar panels that give just some slight incremental improved efficiencies. In fact, the next technology is likely to use about 50% more silver, and the technology to follow on after that is likely to use as much as 150% the current amount of silver. So this is very, very supportive of the silver market and for higher silver prices. And, you know, silver, about 20 grams, so that's about two-thirds of an ounce of silver goes into each solar panel. This is just roughly. So if you think about it, if you think about the cost of silver, an ounce of silver is at, say, being $18 or $20, so really about maybe $12, $13, $14 of silver goes into a silver panel that is a lot more expensive. So the silver panel manufacturers, obviously they try to reduce the amount of silver. There are limits to that, to efficiencies, to the amount of silver that goes into each panel. But because the net cost of the amount of silver that goes into one panel is relatively low, it's not a factor that would higher silver prices, or at least reasonably higher silver prices, even a doubling or tripling, would likely not be enough to slow down the production of solar. In fact, in some places, solar is the single cheapest next source of power, of electricity. Some countries, for example, Vietnam, I had read recently, is adding solar because it's the single cheapest source of electricity for them. So solar is very big, and it's a green energy source of electricity. Governments are very supportive. And we talked about the economy. You know, if the Fed, there is a recession, and then governments and central planners are starting to look for ways to support the economy and get things kickstarted once again. We saw this in the year or two after COVID, that all of the green energy and green sector was very, very much supported by government. And this is almost on a unanimous worldwide basis. So you could readily assume that solar being considered very green would continue to get a lot of support. I feel that industrial demand will continue to provide a floor under the silver price, a rising floor, in fact, because electronics, electrical, medical, EVs, these things all use silver and growing amounts of silver. These are all growing sectors. And so they will continue to demand more silver. This will help push a steady rise in the price of silver. And then it's the investment side, which we can talk about, which I believe is the wild card that is going to help push silver dramatically higher in the future.
All right, Peter. Well, we have less than a minute left, and I want to ask you about you also cover some silver mining stocks, exploration and mining stocks. I don't know if there are any producers, but silverstockinvestor.com is where people can go to learn more about your work, right?
Silverstockinvestor.com,
and they can subscribe to your newsletter there. And you do cover companies. Maybe just 30 seconds, if you can tell me, what do you look for when you pick silver mining stocks?
So I do cover everything from physical silver, royalty companies, large producers, developers, and junior explorers. And so I have a few filters in terms of who I will consider to include in the portfolio. One of the big ones is jurisdiction. I look for companies working in places that are relatively safer and more secure in terms of not having their properties expropriated or taxes raised dramatically, things like that. I look for, believe it or not, companies whose either they're, if they're producing or if they have a discovery, if they have a an ore body, a deposit, that at least 40 to 50% of the content or the revenues, if they produce, come from silver, which is surprising perhaps, but many companies build themselves as silver companies when they really aren't. And so yeah. Since my newsletter is all about silver and how to invest in silver, there has to be an absolute focus on silver content.
Okay. And, we're going to have to leave it go at that, Peter. We're really out of time. Sorry, we'll have you back and we'll continue the discussion sometime in the near term. Thank you. My apologies, but we do have to go. My engineer is saying time is up. All right, folks, that is it for this week. But next week, Brian Lenny will be with me. He's an engineer and investment newsletter writer as well. And Timberline Resources CEO Patrick Highsmith joins me as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.